It's Let's Talk Legal on the Talk Station, FM 107.1, with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. And as always, gentlemen, good afternoon to you. Thanks for calling. And what is our topic today?
Well, first of all, good afternoon to you, Lockwood. And Wes is with us today. And many times, as we know, he's out at a hearing or in a court trial or something of that nature. But we're glad he's with us today. Mm-hmm. Lockwood, Wes and I are going to talk today, decipher a little bit some of the aspects of guardianship law. A guardian is basically a person, or it can be an institution, but usually it's a person appointed by the court, the superior court, to basically handle the affairs, financial affairs, of a person who is unable to handle their affairs. Mm-hmm. Also, the guardian can be the guardian of the person, meaning that they are the person who they are the authority relative to where that person would be hospitalized or where they would be treated, where they would be in rehabilitation, where they might be in a nursing facility, something of that nature. So there's what's known as the general guardian, which is the guardian of the person and the property. And I would say that most of the times that's kind of where we land. Now, what's important about guardianship right out of the gate here, Lockwood, is that guardianship is, as I mentioned, a formal proceeding with the clerk of Superior Court under the auspices of the Superior Court. And all matters concerning guardianship are going to have to be approved by the clerk of court and sometimes even the Superior Court. There are lots of issues that can come up with a guardianship, the investment portfolio, mm-hmm. the real estate holdings, whatever the assets happen to be for the ward, those assets are going to come into play in the guardianship. The guardian is going to have to file accountings and inventories. They are going to have to seek approval for certain extraordinary expenses, and all of this is going to be looked at very closely, as it should be, by the clerk of court.
Looking at that, I'm wondering, Cecil, and of course Wes Collins is listening and is participating as well, and good morning to you, Wes. You mentioned guardianship. Is there such a thing as a temporary guardianship, or is it as well as a permanent guardianship? How is that established? Because you mentioned a few moments ago instances where someone might be having to go into the hospital for some purpose.
Great question. So under our statutes, Lockwood, there's a particular statute that deals with guardianships. There is a provision for a limited guardianship. And basically how that works is, there would be an appointment of the guardian, and this is the person who makes the decision for the ward, okay, because we have someone who's been mm-hmm. adjudicated incompetent. We're talking about adult guardianship here. There's also guardians for children, but we're discussing adult guardianship. So if the person has been adjudicated incompetent, then a guardian is appointed, and it may be for the person. It may be for the estate. The person is like personal decisions, like medical care, you know, where you live, those type things. And of the estate is with regard to assets, of course. So this person is appointed guardian. Now, the clerk of court who has jurisdiction over this guardianship would have the ability to potentially carve out limits to the guardianship. Mm-hmm. Okay? There could be certain rights that are preserved, like even things like the right to maintain the driver's license.
Right.
Just things like that. So there is reference to a limited guardianship. Now, your question, Lockwood, was more relating to the issue of temporary.
Mm-hmm.
So there's normally not a temporary guardianship per se, meaning the clerk of court normally is not going to enter an order indicating that this person is adjudicated incompetent and there's a guardian, but this is only for the next 60 days. Or it's only when they are suffering from a manic episode, if they have, you know, maybe bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, some type of mental concern. And the reason why is because it's too subjective there. Okay, who says this person is in a manic episode right now or not? You know, so what happens is that it's when a guardian is appointed, it's a permanent situation, but the competency of the person can be restored by filing what's called a petition to restore competency before the clerk of court. And then you have a hearing before the clerk. We've done this many times before, and sometimes it kind of ends up being a full-blown trial because you do have a right to a jury of six people on this issue. But nevertheless, then the clerk of court decides based on the evidence whether the person has improved to the point where now they don't need a guardian anymore. We're going to restore their competency. And that may be in a situation where, let's say, the necessity of the guardianship was based upon the fact that the person had gotten off their medication, so to speak. Okay? And now they've gotten regulated, the medication's regulated, they're doing well, they're stable, so on and so forth. And therefore, as a result of that, they can make their own decisions. They're not a danger to themselves or others. And then the clerk, under that circumstance, could, you know, hear evidence on that and make a determination to restore competency if the clerk deems that appropriate after considering the evidence. So that's kind of the way that cookie crumbles with regard to temporary. It can be restored. You just have to go through the procedure to do it. It doesn't happen automatically.
I'm also very interested because Cecil mentions our trial court. And this, of course, comes under the category and under the auspices of the Superior Court, if I understood your description of that correctly, Cecil. So in an instance where an individual has lost control of his or her rights to privileges to driving or to access to money and things of this nature, and then, as you've just pointed out, has gained, I'll use the word competency, control of their life, and they say, okay, I'd like to have my all of my responsibility brought back
restored to me.
That's a pretty significant endeavor, and I'm thinking from the perspective of the ward in this case, a shocking situation that so they sometimes have to go to court to prove that they are competent.
Absolutely. And think about that dynamic too, Lockwood.
Ooh.
You have someone who's adjudicated incompetent.
Mm-hmm.
So a person who's adjudicated incompetent legally cannot contract. They don't have the legal authority to enter a contract.
Right.
So let's say they were taken advantage of, or let's say they even decided to just sign a credit card application. They got a credit card, they ran up the debt. Well, they're not responsible for it because that's not a contract that's enforceable. Okay, so how does this person who's adjudicated incompetent, if they can't contract, how can they go hire an attorney to represent themselves for purposes of having their competency restored? You kind of understand that?
Yeah, that is a...
Well, the answer to that question is that there is a carve-out in the statute that does allow for someone who's adjudicated to hire legal counsel for certain things, and number one on that list is to represent them in the restoration of competency. So it's just allowed by statute.
We're talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins on the issue of guardianship, and I know that this has occurred in many instances, and I just point on the fact that families sometimes have to take control for time. I'm going to pick on children here for a moment because of drug addiction and you mentioned issues of maybe mental health issues. But at some point, their lives do turn around. They are able to seek competency. But once that is done, how does the court deal with the guardians in that case?
Well, there would be, of course, an accurate inventory. Mm-hmm. There would then be a quote, final accounting. And then there would be the order called a restoration of competency, and things would be back at status quo. The ward, if you will, would have control over their assets. They would have control back over their assets, et cetera, et cetera. Now, Lockwood, of course, kind of begs the question a little bit. We've talked a lot on the program for many years about the fact that, you know, we avoid this guardianship proceeding and the court intervention, if you will, and the clerk and the superior court and all of these good things that are out there for the general public. But let's face it, we do avoid those things most of the time if we have a well-drafted and detailed durable power of attorney, because under the power of attorney, the ward, if you will, the principal is appointing their agent, the person to handle their affairs if they become incompetent, unable to handle their affairs. So let's just kind of put that out there for our listeners to hear once again. Not always, but many times, if we have a power of attorney, we're able to circumvent the guardianship proceeding. The other angle to touch on, again, we're repeating things. It's nice to say things that we've said in past programs, Lockwood, is that, you know, this is serious business. Just like being the agent under a power of attorney, being the guardian under a court-ordered guardianship, you are in charge of the property of another. And it's not your property. It's not your real estate. It's not your stock account, your bank account. It's the ward's assets. It's the principal under the power of attorney asset. And you need guidance. You need good legal guidance to keep you on the straight and narrow if you've been put in one of these positions, either as an agent under a power of attorney or as a guardian under a guardianship. It's important that you seek legal advice and that you dot your I's and cross your T's, because you are handling the property of another person. And, yes, that person at some point may improve, may recover, may be able to take back the title to their assets. And if their home has been sold without a court order, or certain assets have been liquidated that shouldn't have been liquidated, and the list kind of goes on, as one can imagine, Lockwood, then the principal could very likely, you know, have a cause of action, if you will, against the agent or the guardian for failure to act in a reasonable way with regard to their assets. So it's kind of a web of things that our listeners need to kind of begin to understand.
This brings a scary discussion here. We're talking with Wes Collins and Cecil Harvell, and that was Cecil Harvell there of Harvell and Collins, about the issue of guardianship. As we continue this conversation, Cecil and Wes, one of the things that you touch on, and I often touch on as well, Cecil, is that of liability. And at the same time that you have this issue of liability, as, for example, let's say I'm established as a guardian, and another area of concern, I would think, is in elder care and the fact that sometimes someone's life changes radically all of a sudden, and children find themselves now having to take over as guardians of their parents. Is the issue of liability, which you touch on, but also the cost of accomplishing the task of being a guardian, because there are a lot of it strikes me a lot of very arduous decisions. For example, and I'll be very quick in asking the question. And let's say, for example, you're taking care of an elderly parent who suddenly became incapacitated. The child suddenly becomes the guardian for the parent, and the parent's life is slowly, diminishing. And the child knows that, needs to pay for expenses, for example, health care, things of this nature, what is the right of the guardian in this case to take action to proceed to provide services to the ward?
Yeah, when you're talking about cost and expenses and those type things, then, you know, once there's been an adjudication of incompetence and a guardian has been appointed, and then the guardian has access to the assets of the ward, then obviously the guardian uses those assets for the benefit of the ward. Meaning, you know, might pay the mortgage payment,
right?
Might pay for groceries, pay for utilities, you know, these type of things. And that's all, of course, legitimate. It could be, there could be circumstances in which the guardian is using his or her own money under whatever the situation may be for the Bennett Ward, or has used his or her own money before the adjudication and would be entitled to apply to the court to be reimbursed. Attorney's fees is a part of that. Because, you know, sometimes, let's say you have a child who is concerned that their parent is, you know, obviously dealing with some type of, maybe it's dementia, Alzheimer's, whatever it may be, and they feel as though they're being taken advantage of. And sometimes when we see this situation, the adult has diminished to the point where maybe, let's say, the caregiver is taking advantage of them, or maybe someone who's a significant other to them, a girlfriend or boyfriend. And sometimes the relationship with this person diminished, the parent, with their own child is deteriorated as a result, because they're not really seeing things clearly, because they're being manipulated by the supposed girlfriend or boyfriend. We've all heard these stories before. Unfortunately, we see these in what we do for a living quite often. So it could be that the child says, okay, Cecil, Wes, I want to proceed with a guardianship because my dad's girlfriend here is taking money from him, and she's turned him against me, and this is not what my dad's like, and, you know, he must have dementia or Alzheimer's, or what can I do? Well, in going through the guardianship process, that brings transparency to the entire situation. Gives us an opportunity for the father under that scenario to be evaluated so we can determine whether there's a lack of capacity there to the point where it would rise to being incompetent. But those initial kind of things to do at the beginning to proceed forward with the for adjudication of incompetence costs money. Well, where's that money going to come from? Well, it's probably going to come from the child. Because it's not going to come from the father here, because we're kind of on the outs with the father under the unfortunate scenario. So in the event that the father under that scenario is adjudicated incompetent and is appointed, then it would be appropriate for the child then to make application through a petition or a motion before the court to be reimbursed for the money that they spent to protect their parent. Okay? So sometimes there's an initial outlay of the child, but then there's reimbursement from the estate of the depending on how the guardianship proceeding goes.
Do some of these cases end up literally in a trial environment where a child says, you know, as we just pick that scenario, the father is being abused by a caregiver or a girlfriend in this case, and the child says, my father is incompetent. Can this end up literally in a trial court?
First thing, it is very often highly contested and ends up being a trial before the clerk of court, with the clerk being the judge.
Mm-hmm.
Under certain circumstances, you can even have a trial by jury.
Whew.
With the clerk acting as the judge, because the respondent, who is the person we say is incompetent but has not been adjudicated incompetent yet, has the right to request a jury to make a determination whether they're incompetent or not. So you can even have a jury trial. And then in the other situation in which you have a jury trial, would be in this that restoration of competency issue we talked about at the beginning of this program, Lockwood?
Well, I was going to respond to, you know, can it evolve into a trial and or even a jury trial? And Wes, of course, just answered that. But absolutely, we're very busy in this area of the law. You know, we have cases, for instance, where an elder person, according to their child, is receiving this happens to be a lady who is receiving a gentleman friend into her home who the children feel, the adult children, I mean, children like, mm-hmm. you know, like our age, 50-year-old children, feel that the gentleman then is abusing the mother. Mm-hmm. She, on the other hand, makes comments like, well, I have invited him into the home. Why are you challenging me on this? He's my friend, things of that nature. So we many times see factual scenarios where the person who is potentially being abused, either financially or even physically, they do not comprehend, they do not accept that they are being abused.
Right.
This is particularly true with financial fraud, internet fraud, internet girlfriends and boyfriends that are having elderly wire money to a certain account and are being defrauded. Or a caregiver even who is encouraging an elder person to withdraw money from their bank account for whatever reason. When we then talk with the elder person, they, of course, push back many times on these facts and say, oh, no, 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 that is not financial fraud. That's a reliable person. I've been speaking to him on the telephone for months now. He's become my close friend, et cetera, et cetera. And so there is a pushback. Unfortunately, we then have to advocate and put this before a judicial forum. Thank goodness we have great clerks of court and great judges, and they sift through all of these facts and circumstances and different testimony and evidence. The doctor's opinions are always very important and heavily relied upon, and a decision can get made. Occasionally, it is a bit in the gray zone. We've had files like that. Sometimes when they become, I have a file like this right now, when they become somewhat controversial and the facts are not completely in agreement, the elder person, though, will now agree that they will transfer a considerable amount of their funds into some sort of trust, if you will, so that they are protected and under the auspices of their child. In other words, there would have to be a dual signature, something of that nature. So even though mom feels that she's not being defrauded by the internet friend that she's known for a year, she's willing to put her assets, even her home, if you will, into a trust so that if anything more begins to happen in a considerable way, then the child, as the trustee of the trust, is in the loop. I hope I'm making sense there.
Yeah, no, that does. Makes a lot of sense. And,
yes.
And in essence, you're finding a bridge to a solution without getting into a controversy. You bring up the topic, and I'm thinking about this in relationship to a durable power of attorney. Does that in any way ameliorate this kind of situation, or is that actually just a different aspect altogether?
Yeah, the power of attorney question is that, you know, and oftentimes the power of attorney can eliminate the necessity of proceeding with a guardianship.
Okay.
But the problem that you run into sometimes is that if the person has not been adjudicated incompetent, and they have a power of attorney, and let's say they're suffering from Alzheimer's, dementia, then in that, let's say that they don't see eye to eye with you, and you hold the power of attorney for them, and you're trying to do things in their best interest, and you say, tell them things like this relationship with this person that you say that you care about is not healthy because they're stealing money from you or whatever it may be,
mm-hmm.
Well, they can revoke that power of attorney anytime they want.
Ooh. Okay.
Acting as power of attorney doesn't allow you to trump the decision of the principal. acting as a guardian does. It only allows you to act for the person, the principal of the power of attorney.
That is a very clear distinction. I appreciate that. We're talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. We're talking about guardianships. We got into the issue of durable powers of attorney. I'm looking forward to future conversations on this. This is, again, as we see more and more elder care being an issue, I think a big conversation for our a worthwhile conversation for our audience to think about. And with that, just to thank our hosts for the program, quite frankly, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. And to remind you, Harvell and Collins, go to that website and spell out the word and, harvellandcollins.com. And, of course, the number, 252 area code, 726-9050, 726-9050. Wes, Cecil, thanks for your time today.
Thanks, Lockwood.